I think it's much more interesting to live not knowing than have answers which might be wrong.
It's not really about going to another solar system. It's about how do we improve life here on Earth.
Not only the question, but the way you try to solve it.
Beauty at this dimension, one symphony, is also beauty at a smaller dimension.
Hello and good evening. You're listening to UBC Sharing Science Radio, broadcasting live from CITR 101.9 FM on unceded Musqueam territory at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, Canada. Sharing Science Radio is here to bring you a weekly dose of science news, discussion, interviews, and local events. I'm this week's host, Alan Manning, and with me today are
Sam Livingston,
Rohit Singla.
On tonight's show, we're talking batteries. We'll be hearing about wireless charging, home batteries for the smart grid, and getting down and dirty with electrochemistry. Oh yeah. We'll also hear from UBC chemist Mark McLaughlin on creating new materials, chemistry, and rural science. But first, what exactly is a battery? We all know that a battery creates electricity when you make an uninterrupted conducting path from one side to the other. Electrons flow out of the negative terminal, the anode, that's the thing marked with a little minus, through your iPhone or flashlight or whatever, and into the positive terminal, the cathode, that's the part marked with the plus. But we're only seeing half the story. It's the useful half, but we're missing out on all the awesome chemistry that's taking place inside the battery itself. So all batteries have two chemical reactions going at the same time. At the negative terminal, you've basically got a chemical reaction that rips electrons off molecules, leaving behind positively charged ions. At the negative terminal, the reaction takes electrons and slaps them onto positively charged ions, creating a neutral molecule or atom. So one side is producing electrons, and one side is consuming electrons. The real trick to batteries is using clever chemistry to make sure the electrons have no other route from the negative terminal, where they're being released, to the positive terminal, where they're being consumed. We've got to give them no other choice except to travel outside the battery. So they make the trip out from the negative side, the anode, through your laptop circuit or cell phone circuit or whatever, back into the other side, the cathode. And rechargeable batteries just make electrons run the other way around to run the chemical reactions in reverse, charging up the battery. A lot of battery research has been done today focusing on what happens inside the battery. Because while electrons are gallivanting around the circuit outside, ions are traveling back and forth between the positive terminal and the negative terminal inside the battery. And improving the ease of trip for these ions and letting them pack closer together at the electrodes is how we achieve batteries with better energy density. And this is actually a really hard problem. Every part of our laptops and cell phones seem to improve at an exponential rate, except for the battery. But we are making progress. And today we'll be hearing about some recent breakthroughs in battery technology.
Imagine the world running off solar energy. Well, it's almost becoming a reality. Tesla Energy, yes, the same Elon Musk from the same company that brings you those fancy electric cars, has revealed their attempt at a home battery system just last month. It comes in the form of two products, the Powerwall and the PowerPack. Both of these systems use stored solar energy generated from solar panels. How it works is that a solar panel is installed on your rooftop, which converts the sunlight into electricity. The electricity from these panels, when the utility rates are low or when the sun's out during the day, is stored into Powerwall. From there, the stored direct current is put through an inverter, which converts it from direct current to alternating current for use in your average home appliances. While this might sound familiar, it's been very hard to do at a large scale. But Elon Musk is claiming that he can do this for, well, infinity. While the Powerwall is meant to be a smart grid for your home, it can have up to 10 or 7 kilowatt hours per unit, sized at about 3 by 4 feet, a little bit bigger than your checked baggage when you take it on the airplane. The Powerwall acts as a way to go off the grid entirely, or have a backup for emergencies. That's pretty cool. But what about PowerPack? Well, needless to say, it packs a punch. It's intended for industrial applications, and maybe even utility companies themselves, like BC Hydro. The PowerPack comes in 100 kilowatt blocks that can scale up to, well, as Elon Musk says, whatever you want. These power packs can go up to 500 to even megawatts to millions, and Elon Musk is claiming that they can power the United States, and with a few billion of them, they can power the entire world. How crazy is that?
Do you ever find yourself working on an assignment, playing games, or texting a friend using your laptop or phone, and realize that they're about to die because you forgot your charger at home? Well, never fear, because science is working on a solution. A group of researchers from the University of Washington have been researching the possibility of wireless charging of electronics for several years, and their latest work has taken another step forward, designing a batteryless camera and temperature sensing device that exclusively uses energy waves produced by a Wi-Fi router as a source of energy. Wireless charging of electronics is not new, as it is currently being used for hearing implants in the ear. But what distinguishes this work from others is the ability to use far-field waves, which enables the powering of electronics from distances up to 20 meters away from the source of the energy waves, which in this case was a Wi-Fi router. The group is also developing devices that use the background electromagnetic waves produced by cell phone towers, TV stations, and radio stations as a means of powering devices, and so far have produced a set of devices capable of communicating with one another simply using these sources of electromagnetic waves. While the technology is still years away from being able to power our high-energy consuming devices, we should expect to see more complex devices being created with a batteryless design.
Okay, thanks for those stories, Rohit and Sam. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back with some discussion on what we just heard.
Vancouver is once again rated the world's most boring city. I repeat, the world's most boring city. You literally can't do anything here except pay for overpriced drinks and food and potentially enjoy some music. Vancouver is known actually don't to enjoy, be a dull, but pretending to boring, enjoy it so that you can lame, fit in with a bunch of people that I don't care about. Absolutely drab, soulless, I don't know what else to say. You suck, Vancouver.
You suck.
Oh. Oh no. Well, at least we have Discorder.
Pick up a fresh edition of Discorder magazine at your local venues and record stores. We have the latest news on venues, concert reviews, cultural events, and more. This month features articles on Stefana Fertilla, Softus, Tim the Mute, Levitation Fest Vancouver, and Music Waste. Special thanks goes out to this month's sponsors, including Mint Records, The Rio Theater, Rickshaw, Vinyl Records, Live Van, and AMS Events.
Welcome back to UBC Sharing Science Radio on CITR 101.9 FM. So we're going to take a little bit of a discussion now on what we just heard. First of all, let's talk about the electromagnetic spectrum. So, Sam, you talked about a device that captures radio waves, and Rohit, you were talking about solar energy. So what do these two have in common?
So it's interesting you say that, because really, all these things, they come from the same electromagnetic spectrum. So really, the electromagnetic spectrum is how we define all these waves. We define them through their wavelength in meters, through the frequency, so the waves per second, and even the energy each wave carries. On one end, we have hard X-rays and gamma rays, and on the other, we have AM radio and FM radio waves. And in the middle, even some light.
Okay, so light and radio waves are on the same spectrum.
Yeah, that's right.
And these things are all made up of photons, actually. You've probably heard about photons with respect to light, but actually radio waves are made up as photons as well.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Alan.
So, Sam, in your story, the device was capturing radio waves?
That's correct, yeah.
So that's pretty interesting, to me at least, because we're surrounded by all these different types of waves, and for the longest time, it sounds like we've just been restricted to plugging in our phones, and now people are actually harvesting all this ambient energy around us?
Yeah, and like we mentioned in the introduction, the wireless charging phenomenon is not something that's new, and it's being used for both charging pacemakers as well as hearing implants in ears. But right now it's limited to the very short distance where you have your source of energy, which is, I'm not entirely sure what is being used for charging these appliances,
but they have to be very close to the source of where the radiation is coming from. And this group is showing that you can do it over the course of much longer distances, depending on what the source is. So in the one study that they just published, they were using the normal Wi-Fi router that you have in your home as a source of energy to charge your different appliances and devices that use electricity.
Okay, so Sam, I got a question, because if you're using energy from your Wi-Fi router to charge your phone, then what's happening to your Wi-Fi signal?
Well, one of the things that they were looking at here is how they could receive the radiation and then re-emit it back in the same form. So this group showed that they were able to absorb the energy that is coming from the Wi-Fi router, and it's going to be only temporarily inside the device before it's re-emitted and reflected back into the abyss, the air that is around us, where it's actually supposed to be going. So if the energy waves that are coming from the Wi-Fi that's sending your internet signal from the router to your computer, it's momentarily taking the energy in between, and then it's re-emitting the energy back to your computer.
You know what? That sounds like some NSA stuff right there. Like, I've got a device getting my signals. Is it altering the signals? Is it doing anything with them, or what?
That's a good question. I didn't see they addressed that. But one of the things that they talked about for a different study, one that wasn't using the Wi-Fi routers in particular, but they were saying that these two devices were able to communicate with one another. And this wasn't done through an internet connection or a mobile data type situation. This was strictly a local communication between two devices. So I'm interested to find out what implications that has for other devices that could jump in there. And something that just came to my mind is the tap credit cards that you have now that you can just walk around. I've heard some reports saying that people can walk around with a device that's able to, if they pushed it up against your pocket where your wallet is, they can charge your credit card without you knowing.
Yeah, for sure. Like for me, I personally don't use a tap credit card, but there are these NFC readers or RFID readers. Even there's a circuit.
Wait, hold on. Sorry. What's RFID?
So radio frequency identification, that's essentially using radio waves to identify a certain device. It's commonly
like at a store, you know, when you buy something and there's a chunky, it looks like a crop circle made out of metal. Sometimes you see them pasted on the outside. That's an RFID, right?
Yeah, Alan. Okay. Yeah, exactly. And so it's interesting to see. It's waves are just interesting in general, I think, but it's interesting. Another question for you, Sam, is that would charging your device wirelessly have any impact on signal strength? So say I send Wi-Fi to it to charge, does my Wi-Fi lose power?
Another great question, and this was actually one of the main focuses of this study with the Wi-Fi routers. They established these devices and they put in 6 different routers into 6 different homes within the Seattle community. And the first 4 homes, they reported that there was absolutely no difference between the internet connection of their Wi-Fi router while they were using this device that's supposed to capture the radio waves before it reaches their computer. One of the homes actually reported that they had a better internet connection afterwards. But the authors actually, they didn't take credit for that. They said that the router that they had before, it just was very low capabilities and very low specifications. So it was just that the study was introducing a new router.
Okay, I'm gonna take issue with that, but let's save that for a few minutes when we talk about energy conservation. Rohit, why don't we move now to talking about the Powerwall unit? So you mentioned that was something that was part of the smart grid, and what's this idea of the smart grid? It's kind of one of these buzzwords that we get.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, a smart grid is kind of a buzzword. It's the whole greenwashing thing. But anyways. So the idea here for the Powerwall and the power pack, at least, is that the system will be plugged into the internet, and there's some sort of intelligence, some sort of logic into what it does and its operation. Part of it will be logging and making sure that you're not using energy when you don't need to, that you're actually storing energy when you need to. So when utility rates are actually low or when the sun's actually out, that's when you'll be wanting to have this system on. And then we have this idea of a smart grid, which I think you know a bit about, Alan, right?
Yeah, so maybe I can jump in here with one example, and I think shows what the idea is exactly. So typically, the way electricity distribution is typically work is you have your power station, and then electricity is produced in one central area and then gets distributed to homes and industries and what have you. The idea with the smart grid, though, is that now with a lot of renewable energy sources coming online, like solar, wind, things that produce power at certain times of the day and often not during the times of the day where there's a big load on the grid. So you need to have you need to be able to store electricity, and that's pretty hard to do. As we've been talking about with batteries, they're getting better, but they're still not that great. So storing electricity is quite hard. So one way to do it is, let's say you have a warehouse that has refrigerated products, so food, maybe it's full of meat or something, and this warehouse needs to maintain its products below a certain temperature. So what you can do is you can cool this warehouse down below the temperature it needs to maintain, maybe 10 degrees or 5 degrees, and then you can cool it down at the part of the day where it's not, where utility rates are pretty cheap. So I don't know, maybe in the middle of the day when not many people are at home, and you can cool it down and then turn it off. And then when utility rates are expensive, the warehouse isn't drawing any power. So that's the idea of a smart grid, is things can use power during the cheapest times of the day, and hopefully the average load is evened out, because really you need to build power plants to accommodate the highest load possible, which is often much higher than the average load itself.
For sure. I think the term there is load shifting, actually, where you spread out the load and even it out a bit.
Having lived in Ontario, I know that the electricity and hydro companies have done paper use and when you use. So in order to offset the working hours and the mornings and evenings where there's a huge load on the system to use a lot of electricity and water, they incentivize you using it earlier or later in the evenings by charging you a little less money instead of having it at the peak hours. So that seems like it's a central problem in this situation too.
Yeah, for sure. The other interesting part here is the claim for scalability. I mean, Tesla, as great as they are and as revolutionary as they are saying that with their system they can power the world. And I think that's a bold claim, but I don't know. What about you guys?
Well, it seems like every claim that Elon Musk makes, whether it's possible or not, it's out there, right?
Yeah.
I mean...
But then consider, like, maintainability for these units, right? We're talking about energy storage here in these batteries. Solar energy is generated through solar panels, and we're just storing that energy up. At some point in time, we got to consider whether we can maintain these units over the course of not only 10 or 20 years, but 50 years, or even more, right? And even just the efficiency rates is what we're using right now. Is our energy demand going to grow, which I'm going to go out on a limb here and say yes, it will grow.
Certainly with the growing population.
Yeah, by all means. Like, just because we're talking about climate change, which is sweet, is this going to be okay for the future?
Definitely something to think about, right? How is it going to scale up? I definitely have a man crush on Elon Musk, so I'm rooting for him here.
Awkward.
So we'll see. I think it's an exciting step, because really that's kind of the final piece of the puzzle to integrate renewable energy like solar and wind into the grid.
that was actually for a bit there, a bit of their promo, is that they called it the missing piece.
Oh,
and then
okay.
They revealed it. So
okay, so if you're listening, Elon, you can hire me at SpaceX or Tesla anytime.
There you go.
Okay, so let's move on to one last piece, and this is to do with energy conservation. So Sam, going back to your piece where you said we had that device that was powered by radio waves and people put inside their house and they didn't notice that their Wi-Fi connection had gone down and it was being powered from the Wi-Fi connection. Well, you can't get something for nothing. So let's say you have these devices become very widespread and suddenly everyone's tapping into the cell phone signals. The cell phone signal is going to go down. Like there's no other way that it can possibly happen. You can't produce energy out of nothing. And, you know, in that house, maybe the amount of energy that your cell phone is using is significantly less than a Wi-Fi router is pumping out. I bet it is. I mean, if you put your hand on a Wi-Fi router, it's usually quite warm. But that's just something to consider.
Well, another great point, Alan, because these devices are at a very baseline stage where they're not consuming a ton of energy at this point. the devices that they used for this study was just a single camera that was able to take a picture once every 35 seconds. So that really, when you consider it, it's not that much energy compared to how we can take videos and play games on our phones, and it only consumes, what, a 0.5% of your battery? So I think that you're absolutely right. Like, these are... The context of the study always talks about, just like any other study, is was it a significant decrease from what you normally have? And I guess that's what they reported, is that there was no significant decrease. And I didn't get to see the data itself. Not that I would be able to interpret it anyways. But it's one of those things where you, as the devices get more and more powerful, like you talked about during the battery introduction, it's they're going to consume so much more battery. And with the number of things that are tapping into this, I'm sure that it will go down.
Okay. Well, we've had great discussion today. Definitely some exciting technology and new advances coming out of the battery sector. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have for today. So I'd like to thank Rohit and Sam for contributing their stories and excellent discussion. We're going to move on now to an interview of Mark McLaughlin, a chemistry professor at UBC.
I think I decided I wanted to be a scientist or a professor in my first year of university. I came to UBC thinking I'd be a doctor or a dentist, but after a few weeks in the university, I realized I wanted to be a professor.
What does your research group study right now?
We make new materials, all kinds of new materials, especially materials with nanostructures that are inspired by nature.
1 nanometer is a billionth of a meter.
So we work with materials that are about 1/1000th to 10,000th the size of a human hair.
I guess our biggest discovery was making new materials that have the same structure and optical properties as some beetle shells. So inside of the beetle shell, the jewel beetle has a shell that gets its green iridescence from a helical organization of chitin nanocrystals. And we've been able to use cellulose nanocrystals obtained from pulp and paper to obtain the same effects in pieces of glass. We're working with nanocrystals that are about 5 to 10 nanometers in diameter and a couple hundred nanometers long.
This helical structure, that's actually what gives the, for talking about the jewel beetle, that's what causes the iridescence?
Yeah, the jewel beetle gets its iridescence from a helical organization of chitin in the beetle shell. And this has an angle dependence, so it will change color depending on the viewing angle that you look at it.
So if you're just looking at it from straight above, it might appear greenish, and if you're looking at it from the side, it might appear sort of
more red in
more
color,
red.
For
okay.
example.
Okay. So this chitin, is that a molecule that's similar to cellulose?
Chitin is very similar to cellulose.
Okay.
And it is the major structural building block of arthropod or crab shells and shrimp shells, beetle shells.
So your lettuce is crunchy because of cellulose, but you step on a bug, it's crunchy because of chitin. Is that?
Yeah, that's right.
The materials you guys use, were you inspired by the beetle shells in nature?
We actually discovered our materials by accident. We were initially trying to make a piece of glass that has holes with no particular organization. We were taking cellulose nanocrystals and combining them with glass and then removing the cellulose to make new hydrogen storage materials that could be used for hydrogen-powered cars, for example. But we discovered when we were doing this chemistry that some of the pieces of glass were colored. And when we dug into the literature, we realized that the cellulose nanocrystals were actually known to form this helical structure that mimics the structure of chitin in the jewel beetle shell. And that was the origin of the color. I think a lot of the most exciting discoveries are by accident.
Do you guys do your work on your own, or do you collaborate with other research groups?
We collaborate a lot in our research. With the cellulose nanocrystal work, we're working with a local company, FP Innovations, that provide the cellulose nanocrystals and provide a lot of expertise and collaborative opportunities. We also collaborate with researchers in other countries, such as Italy, for doing computation of our materials. And we have collaborations with researchers in China and other countries.
In your typical workday, how many hours do you spend in your lab?
I don't even set foot in my lab normally.
is that self-imposed, or is that something your students have...
I think my students are afraid when I set foot in the lab. No, I usually spend half an hour in the lab each day just talking to students to find out what they're up to.
Okay.
But I haven't done an experiment myself for many years. Okay. I think when I started, I was working in the lab about 8 hours a day.
And what were some of the challenges that you faced as a new professor?
Yeah, it's an interesting job. When you start as an assistant professor, you get an empty lab, an empty office, and you're told to go. There's no direction. You have no real boss. You have to suddenly manage a team of researchers, hire people, raise funding, learn how to write papers and things. I found it very challenging to get going, especially getting the initial research results. We started with some projects that were maybe too ambitious and some other ones that just took us a long time to get them to work. It's very frustrating when you go for a year or two without any significant results.
One of the things you've done outside your research is you started the INSPIRE program. Can you tell us a little bit about that, what it is?
INSPIRE is the Interactive Scientists and Professors in Residence program. And this started as an idea that I had because I felt like growing up in a small community in central BC, that I didn't have exposure to a lot of scientists. I never met somebody who had a PhD until I came to UBC for my undergraduate degree. And I thought this would be a great idea for students, graduate students or professors, to go and spend a month in communities around the interior of BC and function as a scientist in residence. So the idea is that they go and they spend time interacting with students in schools and the teachers and trying to inspire an interest in science in both the teachers and the students.
So you said you started university to become a doctor or a dentist. Were you inspired to go along that sort of scientific career path from something in your childhood, or?
I always loved science and math growing up, and I remember in grade 3, a science experiment that I remember very well was we were given a series of plastic bags that each contained a white substance, and our job over the next week was to be sleuths and figure out what these mystery white powders were. And so we used scientific techniques. You tasted it, you put it under a microscope and looked at the crystals, and you tested to see if they were soluble in water, and so on. So basically, you were like a scientist. And then only later did you find out that you had eaten a sample of plaster of Paris and other things that probably shouldn't have been tested.
Rural areas obviously don't have access to the same resources that cities like Vancouver do. Do you think this, that the students in those areas are less likely to go into science because of that?
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, becoming a professor or becoming a scientist was never something that I ever had considered or any of the students that I grew up with had considered.
Can you describe your typical wardrobe so that listeners can recognize you if they see you on campus?
My daily wardrobe is a pair of jeans or shorts and a Hawaiian shirt.
Even in the winter?
Absolutely.
Fantastic. What's something about chemistry you wish more people knew?
I wish everybody realized that chemistry is good. If you look around, everything that we have come to enjoy is a result of chemistry. And I think chemistry has a bad rap, unfortunately, just because of a few small incidences. But overall, it's hard to imagine how our life would be without chemistry.
Okay, thanks Mark McLaughlin for sharing some science and wardrobe selection tips with us. That's all the time we have this week. Thank you Sam and Rohit. I'm Alan Manning, and that was Sharing Science Radio. Stick around to hear some music from our friends over at Sam Squanch's Hideaway.